From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, bitter enemies shook hands after the signing of a historic peace agreement between Israel and the PLO. On today's Fresh Air, the reflections of a Palestinian-American and an American-born Israeli. Zev Chaifetz is columnist for the Jerusalem Report and former head of the Israeli government press office. He describes himself as a hawk who supports the peace agreement. Nasir Arouri is a professor of political science and a member of the Palestine National Council, the Palestinian parliament in exile. He supports the step toward peace, but has serious concerns about the next steps. Reflections on the peace agreement coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat shook hands today as part of the ceremony agreeing to Palestinian self-rule in the Gaza Strip and Jericho. President Clinton pledged that the United States will try to help extend the agreement into a broader peace throughout the Middle East. The process is expected to continue tomorrow with the announcement that Israel and Jordan have reached agreement on a negotiating agenda that could lead to a peace treaty and diplomatic relations. Today's ceremony was attended by some 3,000 people, including former Presidents Carter and Bush, who each helped to advance the process that led to the interim peace agreement. There have been mixed reactions among Palestinians to the signing ceremony today. From Tunis, Jackie Rowland reports.
Across the Tunisian capital, the 2,000-strong Palestinian community was huddled round television sets to watch the ceremony in Washington. For some, it was a triumphant moment, the first step to nationhood. But for others, it left a bitter taste in the mouth. The PLO leader Yasser Arafat's wife, Suha, said it marked the beginning of the end of the suffering for both Palestinians and Israelis. But other PLO members were less enthusiastic. A senior official who resigned from the organization's leadership last week said it was a sad day. PLO radicals went further. They predicted that the agreement would not lead to a just and lasting peace in the Middle East. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Tunis.
Rebel forces in Angola appear to be on the verge of capturing another key town, at the same time that representatives in Lisbon have offered to declare a ceasefire. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports.
In Portugal, a delegation from the UNITA rebel movement said today its forces would implement a unilateral ceasefire in Angola a week from today. UNITA member Carlos Fontoura said the move was being made to assist the resumption of peace talks between the rebels and the Angolan government. Last weekend, another diplomatic initiative failed. UNITA leader Jonas Savimbi had been invited to meet in Gabon with Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe and Alioune Blondin Bey, the UN Special Representative to Angola. But Savimbi, whose rebels control about 75% of Angola, said he could not leave the country because of heavy fighting. The rebel leader has refused conditional offers to negotiate an end to Angola's civil war, which began in January, following Savimbi's defeat in the country's first democratic elections. I'm Sunni Khalid in Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 12 points to close at 3,634. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 4 points at 740.3. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 243 million shares. This is NPR News. President Clinton took a step today toward easing economic sanctions against Vietnam, but he stopped short of lifting the U.S. trade embargo until Hanoi resolves the prisoner of war issue. The president said that American companies may compete for contracts from international development projects in Vietnam. The White House said the action was taken in recognition of Hanoi's recent cooperation on POW issues and to encourage further progress. The president's decision clears the way for American companies to take part in oil exploration projects in Vietnam. The crew of the shuttle Discovery has completed today's major objective, the release of a German science platform. Dave Pignanelli of member station WFME reports.
The deployment was about 90 minutes behind schedule, but the Orpheus SPA's payload is now orbiting freely in space. Discovery's crew gently lifted the platform of science experiments from the payload bay using the shuttle's 50-foot robot arm. This morning's delay occurred when ground controllers were unable to send commands to the platform because of the position of the shuttle in relation to communication stations on the ground. The agency waited one more orbit and was successful. Orpheus SPA's will now gather information about how stars live and die using a specially designed German ultraviolet telescope. In about a week, the shuttle will move within range of the platform once again and pluck it from space for the trip back to Earth. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
A federal judge has cleared the way for Chicago schools to open tomorrow despite the district's $300 million deficit. District Judge Charles Kokouras waived a state law that prohibits schools from opening without a balanced budget. The nation's third largest school district was to open last Wednesday, but the school board voted against starting classes because there were too many teaching vacancies. The Illinois legislature had imposed a hiring freeze in exchange for an earlier waiver of the balanced budget amendment. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today the world watched something few people believed they would ever see, the Prime Minister of Israel and the chair of the PLO shaking hands. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin admitted that signing a peace agreement wasn't easy, but the time has come to live side by side in dignity and empathy.
We who have come who have come from a land where parents buried their children, we who have fought against you, the Palestinians, we say to you today, in a loud and a clear voice, enough of blood and tears. Enough!
Yasser Arafat spoke in Arabic about the need for peace and the courage it would take.
My people are hoping that this agreement, which we are signing today, marks the beginning of the end of a chapter of pain and suffering which has lasted throughout this century. Let me address the people of Israel and their leaders with whom we are meeting today for the first time. And let me assure them that the difficult decision we reached together was one that required great and exceptional courage.
After the agreement was signed, we called Nasir Aruri, a Palestinian-American, and Zev Chaifetz, an American-born Israeli. We'll hear from Chaifetz first. He's a columnist and former editor at the Jerusalem Report, an Israeli news magazine. At the time of the Camp David Accord between Israel and Egypt, Chaifetz was the head of the Israeli government press office. On the phone from Jerusalem, he told me why he, a self-described hawk, supports this peace agreement.
I'm a hawk in the sense that I think a lot of Israelis are hawks. Let's put it a different way. I think the hawkish camp here divides into several groups. There are those who are ultra-Orthodox or Orthodox and who believe that, you know, God gave all of the land of Israel to the Jewish people and that it is an inalienable right to be here and that we can't give it up because it's a violation of God's promise. Those are the people of Gush Emunim, they're the settler, it's a settler movement and so on. Then there are hawks who, over the years, and I guess Bibi Netanyahu is an example, have come to the feeling that giving up anything to the Palestinians is simply a frightening step. And there are others like me. And when I say I'm a hawk, I worked for 5 years for Menachem Begin, so I have some hawkish credentials, who always believed that we should make a deal with the Palestinians and with the Syrians and with the other Arab states when it was safe to do that. And the when it was safe, in our judgment, or at least in my judgment, and I think I speak for other people who are like me, had to do with when the Arabs actually became reconciled to Israel's right to exist here as a state in the region.
So you think that's what makes it safe now to make an agreement with the PLO?
Yeah, I don't think there's any way to go back from this. This is not a back door deal. It's not a middle of the night. Arafat goes out and mumbles that he accepts Israel kind of a thing that people tried to, you know, people lied to us a lot. From 1973 onward, all kinds of people for all kinds of reasons tried to tell us that the Palestinians, that the PLO, for example, wanted peace with Israel. It didn't. They tried to tell us that the PLO was ready for an accommodation with Israel. It wasn't. And we said all the time that we will know that the PLO is ready when it fulfills certain criteria. For example, canceling the clauses in the Palestinian National Charter that talk about our destruction. For example, saying in public, in a loud voice, in Arabic, that the Palestinians are ready to live with us together. And as long as those things weren't fulfilled, we didn't think that it was prudent or safe to make a deal. But once they're fulfilled, at least in my opinion, it is both prudent and safe and also sensible to make a deal. I think that this is the time to make the deal. I think it's a good deal for us. And I think it's a good deal for the Palestinians, which is the essence of a good deal. It's good for both sides.
What do you think Israelis want the final outcome to be? I mean, do you see this as a step toward a Palestinian state?
I have no doubt that this is a step toward a Palestinian state, and I don't think that the notion of a Palestinian state is the same taboo kind of notion that it was a few years ago or even a few months ago. If we're dealing with Palestinians who are peace-loving and who are interested in an accommodation with us and who want to create a peaceful state next door to us, I think that the majority of Israelis will agree. I certainly agree. If not, if the goal is, as the Likud is saying and the rest of the Israeli right, to simply establish a state for it to be a basis for further attacks on Israel, then, of course, I don't favor that, and nobody here will favor that. But I think that we have to, after all these years, I mean, we've tried wars. We've had lots and lots of wars here. And we know what they can accomplish, and we know what they can deliver. And we need to try the other approach. We need to give them some room to establish some kind of an entity and to take some control over their lives. And if we see that it's successful, if we see that Gaza and Jericho become, you know, flourishing and peaceful places and not hotbeds of terror, then I think that there'll be a sentiment here to go ahead with other similar concessions in other parts of the West Bank, which probably will eventually lead to a Palestinian state, yes.
What do you think the odds are that militant Jewish settlers in the territories will rebel against this plan? And, you know, do you think there's even the possibility of an Israeli civil war as a result of the plan?
No, I don't. There is. I'm going to say categorically, there is no possibility of a Jewish civil war as a result of this plan. The vast majority of the settlers, of the people in the West Bank, the militants, the hardliners, are not people who are going to commit acts of violent resistance. I think that there'll be a few. I think that there'll be some over the years. And I think that they will be containable and contained. Israeli democracy is extremely strong. Extremely strong. It's at least as strong as the other democracies in the world. And there's absolutely no sentiment here and no tolerance here for people who talk about trying to overthrow the decisions of the Knesset, the parliament, and the government by force. It's just not going to fly in this country.
How did you find out about the secret talks that were held in Norway, and what was your reaction when you found out?
Well, I found out the same way all of us did. I found out when it was broadcast and reported in the papers. In fact, I had just, I think 2 days before it became known, had lunch with one of the major principals in the negotiations and talked about, you know, the status of the Israeli-Palestinian talks, and he didn't give me any indication. They were terrific from that point of view about not leaking anything. And so I found out the way all of us found out. And, of course, it was an extremely shocking development. No one was prepared for this speed. But I think people are becoming, you know, are absorbing it now and are gradually becoming becoming more familiar with it and feeling more comfortable with it. There was a poll in the paper today which shows that 63% of Israelis are in favor of the government's program of the Jericho-Gaza first approach. And that, if it's true, is up from about 53% 10 days ago.
Do you think secret talks are about the only way this agreement could have come about?
Well, evidently, there are a couple of things that are quite clear, I think. One is that secret talks are better than public talks, because in public talks you have to appease the hardliners in your own camp, whether it's the Palestinians or the Israelis or whoever. And the other thing is that, oddly enough, when people in this region get serious about peace, the Americans have to be cut out of it.
That's funny, because the Americans always think that they're a kind of crucial part to any agreement.
Well, America is crucial in the sense that we know, and I think the Palestinians know, that the U.S. will stand behind the agreement. As a guarantor, as an underwriter, as a supervisor and so on, America is important. But as a negotiating facilitator, at a certain point, America becomes a nuisance rather than a help. Because in the end of the day, America has its own interests out here. All countries have national interests, and America has its national interests, which are not necessarily compatible either with those of the Palestinians or ours. And so just as Begin and Sadat were able to agree actually behind the backs of the Carter administration, so Arafat and Rabin were able to make an agreement to really behind the back of the Clinton administration. And I don't think that it's a coincidence that every time people get serious about peace, the peace is conducted, the talks are conducted between the parties themselves and without the interference of a third party, even as benevolent a third party as the United States.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Zev Chafetz. He's a columnist and former editor of the Jerusalem Report, and he's the former head of the government press office under Menachem Begin. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Zev Chafetz is my guest. He's speaking with us from Jerusalem. Does the agreement between the PLO and Israel change your opinion of Arafat?
Yeah, it does, as a matter of fact. Arafat, look, I've lived, like all Israelis, with Arafat as a terrorist leader. People say that he was demonized in Israel. But I don't think that's quite true. I think that he demonized himself. He was quite a negative figure. He was a terrorist. And he is a murderer. And those things are not going to be forgotten, and they can't be changed. That's part of history. But I think that Arafat is more than those things. Evidently, he's also a statesman, because he seems to have been able to transcend his own background and his own ideology. I think he had some help with that. I think the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was his principal supporter, helped him to change his ideology. I think the drying up of his economic sources in the Persian Gulf after he supported Saddam Hussein helped him to change his ideology. I think the growth of Islamic fundamentalism among Palestinians helped him to change his ideology. But the fact is that he was capable of doing that. And so I think that we have to look at him without forgetting who he was and who he has been and what he has done. We have to also look at him in terms of what he has become.
Well, do you see him as having become a visionary or an opportunist?
Well, I see him as having become, frankly, kind of a middle-class bourgeois, Western-style political leader. I noticed that Arafat, in his speech and also in the briefings that surrounded his speech, talked a lot about economic development, and talked a lot about prosperity. These are not revolutionary phrases. Arafat started out as a Marxist with a Kalashnikov and a copy of Das Kapital. And he is no longer a Marxist. The world has grown up, and Arafat apparently has grown up with it. And so I don't know that he's a visionary. I'm not so sure what his vision is. I think he probably is an opportunist, but I don't want to make that a pejorative term. I think that Rabin was also an opportunist, because this is an opportunity, and both of these people have taken it.
What do you think is going to happen with resistance from Hamas, the militant Islamic fundamentalist group, which has vowed to fight this peace agreement?
Well, I'm not a great expert on Hamas, but from what I understand, the Hamas representatives have already been talking to the PLO representatives about finding some modus vivendi between them. It was interesting that today there was a kind of a deal. There was a general strike in the morning in the West Bank and Gaza, in which the businesses and so on all shut down, which was called by Hamas, and it was observed by the PLO supporters. And then later in the day, the strike ended, and there were mass celebrations by the PLO supporters, which were not disturbed by Hamas. So it appears that they're moving towards some kind of an understanding, which may be temporary. I don't know. I think that with the Palestinians, like with the Israelis, there is a certain number of people in the margins who are not going to accept this deal. And it will be the Palestinians' responsibility now, the PLO's responsibility in Gaza and Jericho, to deal with this opposition instead of our having to deal with it. And this is one of the very attractive aspects of the deal that we made, that we won't have to send our soldiers to Gaza or to Jericho, but especially to Gaza, which is a violent area, to police the streets. The PLO will do that. And for us, that's a positive development.
Well, do you think a lot of Israelis will be glad to be free of the responsibility toward Gaza and Jericho?
Well, nobody wanted, or very few people. Again, I'll refer to this poll that I saw today. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that only 10% of Israelis said they were sorry to be leaving Gaza. I don't think anybody, or very few Israelis, wanted to be in Gaza. Gaza doesn't resonate for us historically. It's a nasty place. It's a dangerous place. And it's a place that most of us who know it, we Israelis, know it from our military experience, which is not a happy experience there. And so people are glad to be rid of Gaza. The fear is that Gaza will become some sort of a new South Lebanon, a place from which Katyusha rockets will be fired at Israeli cities, a place from which terrorist groups will try to penetrate into Israel. If that happens, then I don't think that Israelis will sit by idly and watch it. I think that we'll put a stop to it. But if it doesn't happen, if it can be stopped by the PLO authorities in Gaza with their police force and with their security forces, which will be cooperating, I understand, with Israeli security forces, then I think people will be delighted to be away, you know, just to be gone from Gaza.
You live in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Palestinians would like to see Jerusalem be Palestinian territory. Yitzhak Rabin has said no way that Israel is going to give up Jerusalem. What do you think the future of Jerusalem is going to be? And do you expect that there's going to be big day-to-day changes for people who live in Jerusalem now?
Well, you know, I lived in Jerusalem for 20 years before the Intifada, during a period in which it was very common for me to go. I used to do my grocery shopping in Jerusalem. We used to go to a Jerusalem hotel, the National Palace, and have our Saturday morning brunch at the National Palace every Saturday for 20 years. And so I know that it's possible for Jews and Arabs to live together harmoniously in Jerusalem, because I've simply seen it happen and participated in it. Since the Intifada, that has not been the case. Now, if the Intifada is over, at least the rock-throwing you know, Molotov cocktail hurling aspects of the Intifada, and it will be once again safe for Jews to visit the Arab parts of Jerusalem, then I think that that will be a change, and it will be a very positive change. As far as the longer term is concerned, obviously both the Palestinians and we have, you know, claims on Jerusalem. And I happen to think that the Jewish claim is a more valid one. But I also think that it's quite clear from the way that these negotiations have been going that the Palestinian claim is one that has to be listened to and in some way satisfied. And one of the tricks of the next stages of negotiation will be the Jerusalem question and how we can square that particular circle, and I believe that we can do it.
You were the press secretary to Menachem Begin at the time of the Camp David Accords. Did you have to try to bring around Israeli public opinion to support the Camp David Accords?
No, because it's a fact of Israeli politics that the left wing can make war and the right wing can make peace.
You might want to explain that.
Well, the left wing, whenever the peaceniks go to war, they have the automatic support of the hawks, which gives them a national consensus. And whenever the right-wingers, the hawks, make peace, they have the automatic support of the left wing, which gives them a national consensus. And so for Begin, public opinion was not a problem. The problem was convincing Begin. Once Begin was convinced, he could bring enough right-wingers to the party that, combined with the left wing, which of course wanted an agreement, was an overwhelming majority. And so we didn't have a problem. Our problem was to try to explain to the Likud voters, to the right-wing public opinion in this country, that what we were signing was not a sellout of Israel. Now, we didn't have any problem with convincing the left or the center. They were easily convincible.
I think a lot of Israelis and Palestinians have hated each other for so many years. Do you think it's possible to, with the signing of a peace treaty, change those emotions?
Absolutely. I absolutely think so. I don't really think, maybe I'm being naive, I don't know many Israelis who hate Palestinians. And I want to hope that there aren't many Palestinians who really hate Israelis. I'm sure that the Palestinians hate the occupation, just as I'm sure that many Israelis hate Palestinian terrorism. But for many years in this country, I mean, let's not forget that there are 110, 120, 140,000 Palestinians who come to work every day in Israel and have for 25 years. And the vast majority of them work side by side or nearby Israelis, and there aren't such terrible problems. And I really believe that if we decide that we can, you know, that we want to make a political peace, that it's possible for us to have an emotional reconciliation. I don't think that it's impossible.
Well, Zev Chaifetz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's a nice day to be talking about peace.
Zev Chaifetz is a columnist for the Jerusalem Report, an Israeli news magazine. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Yasser Arafat said the peace agreement between the PLO and Israel took courage, and it will take more courage. The agreement was worked out in secret. The Palestine National Council, the Palestinian parliament in exile, was not consulted. Coming up, we'll hear from a member of the council, Nasir Arouri. He's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and a former board member of Amnesty International. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. More than 3,000 people watched as Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization, enemies for decades, signed a peace accord today at the White House. The host of the event, President Clinton, called the signing an extraordinary act in one of history's defining dramas. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The actual signing was overshadowed by a gesture as PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin joined hands, a symbol of hope for peace in the Middle East. The entire White House South Lawn was covered with chairs, all facing the walnut table on which the Camp David Accords were signed in 1979. The crowd applauded during the emotional speeches and as each representative signed the two copies of the peace accord. But when Arafat extended his hand to a stony-faced Rabin, the audience rose to cheer. All parties involved spoke of the event as a first step. President Clinton pledged the full assistance of the United States. The event came off without a hitch, although there was some last-minute maneuvering before the ceremony when the word Palestinian was changed to PLO in the preamble to the agreement. After the event, President Clinton brought together American Israelis and American Arabs for another historic first, asking them to support the accord and the people who made it. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Thousands of Palestinians celebrated in the streets of Jericho and Gaza City today after the signing. Islamic fundamentalists who oppose the accord also held demonstrations. In Gaza City, they threw stones at a parade of people celebrating. In Beirut, Lebanese troops fired on a crowd of people demonstrating against the accord, killing 7 people and wounding more than 40. The government banned public gatherings today, and soldiers were told to prohibit demonstrations. Today's agreement is by no means the end of negotiations between Israel and the PLO. 2 years from now, negotiations are to open on an overall settlement, and the two sides will have to deal with tough issues. Barry Schwide reports.
There were low-key Palestinian references at the White House signing ceremony to statehood as a goal. On the Israeli side, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin referred to Jerusalem as Israel's eternal capital. Those references, while made quietly without defiance, are reminders that Israel and the PLO have disparate goals. The PLO intends to turn administrative control over to statehood and to put its capital in Jerusalem. Prime Minister Rabin intends to hold on to Jerusalem, though he didn't rule out a Palestinian state. For the time being, both sides have compromised their goals, causing criticism among Israelis and Palestinians. In a way, they've mostly deferred their disagreement. They have not yet resolved it. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Jordan's prime minister says tomorrow his country and Israel will announce a new set of negotiations, which could lead to a peace treaty and diplomatic relations. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrials gained more than 12 points to close at 3633.93. This is NPR. The Consumer Product Safety Commission is warning victims of the Midwest floods to watch out for waterlogged gas and electrical appliances. The commission says people should have these items checked before they use them again. The agency also warns that wet carpets and other furnishings can breed biological pollutants that can cause illness. Meanwhile, the Federal Trade Commission says some companies will try to profit from flood victims, offering them bogus home repair and other services. Talks on a new contract for Ford auto workers continue today. Negotiators express confidence they'll be able to complete their work prior to tomorrow night's strike deadline. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Wages Wages and health care benefits are the two big issues occupying Ford and the United Auto Workers Union as the deadline approaches. Ford has been pushing for the union's help in cutting the cost of health care. Under the current contract, UAW members at the big three auto companies pay no deductibles for health care coverage, and workers say they won't give any concessions in this area. But the Associated Press reports that one possible compromise will be to defer future cost of living pay hikes to help offset rising health care costs. The two sides are also discussing a Ford proposal under which new hirees would be paid a lower base wage until they have 6 years seniority. The current Ford UAW contract expires at 1 minute before midnight Tuesday, but both sides say they feel a settlement can be reached without a strike. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide charges military officials and the police are conducting a terror campaign in the capital, Port-au-Prince. In a broadcast today to Haiti, Aristide urged the international community to push the police and army out of power. The president's comments come after a pro-Aristide businessman was murdered this weekend. Haitians who challenge police control have received death threats recently. Aristide is due to return to Haiti this fall. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's been a remarkable day. Israel and the PLO have agreed to recognize each other and work toward peace. The first stage is limited autonomy for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and Jericho. The agreement was worked out in secret with the help of Norway. Even the Palestine National Council, the Palestinian parliament in exile, was kept in the dark. My guest Nasir Arouri is a member of the council. Arouri is a Palestinian-American. He's written several books on the Arab-Israeli conflict and is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Arouri is also a former board member of two human rights groups, Amnesty International and Middle East Watch. Two documents were signed today. One is the Declaration of Principles, moving the occupied territories toward limited self-rule. The other is the exchange of letters granting mutual recognition between Israel and the PLO. Arouri says it's too soon to tell what real impact these documents will have on the future.
My skepticism emanates from the feeling that the agreements, that both agreements, seem to be predicated on the assumption that the wrongs that were done here and really produced this conflict were wrongs perhaps that were done by the Palestinians and not to the Palestinians. And the reason I say this is because when you look at the two letters which Rabin wrote to Arafat and Arafat wrote to Rabin, you will see that Mr. Arafat's letter to Rabin consists of six paragraphs. And these six paragraphs contain apologies and commitments that he made, commitments actually that had been made before in 1988 to renounce terrorism. So there is an assumption of responsibility here on the part of the Palestinians, at least in as much as Arafat speaks for a large sector of the Palestinians, that the Palestinians perhaps were engaged in terror when I think most Palestinians think that they were engaged in some form of a national over-resistance to an illegal occupation. And here I think that they do have a good deal of support from the international community. And then when you look at Mr. Rabin's letter to Mr. Arafat, first of all, he does not really say, "Dear Mr. Arafat," he starts it by addressing him without using the dear, and then he says, "In response to your letter of such and such date, and then in light of your commitments, my government has decided to recognize the PLO. It is not a recognition of the Palestinian people. It's recognition of the PLO, and it's a recognition of the PLO for the purpose of negotiating peace with Israel along the lines of what he calls the Middle East peace process." Also, I should say here that the other document, which is the Declaration of Principles, is a document for a very limited self-rule for a very limited number of Palestinians on a very limited geographic space in Palestine. And this agreement, I think, will be judged by what happens during the second phase, and that is the final, second phase of trying to deal with the difficult issues of Jerusalem settlements, refugees, land, and water.
Now, you're on the Palestine National Council, the PLO Parliament in Exile.
Yes.
Arafat decided not to bring the Declaration of Principles to the Palestine National Council until after it was signed.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what your reaction to that is. Do you feel shut out?
Well, of course I do, and I don't think that I'm really the only one who feels shut out. I think that this probably applies to a good number of people who are on the executive, who were kept away from this, even including the negotiators, including the chairman of the negotiating team. I'm struck by the fact that Mr. Rabin had to sign in a hurry and go back so he can deal with his parliament, but I don't really see a similar concern on the part of Mr. Arafat. So I would say that he's not really paying enough attention to the legislative process and to the consultative process.
One PLO official said, "It hurts, you know, this agreement, it hurts, but we had to break the deadlock. We had to start somewhere." Do you agree with that perception, even though, as a member of the council, you feel shut out?
Well, actually, you have to start somewhere, and I think that they did start somewhere. That's why I would say that probably most Palestinians nowadays, I think that it would be safe to say that a majority is hopeful, despite all the difficulties with this agreement. I think that they remain hopeful that perhaps it would lead to something else, even though it's a very limited source of self-government in Jericho and Gaza. I think what's missing, however, from it is a real timetable and an agenda that would connect the two. I mean, other than saying that there will be a second phase, there's really no obligation on the part of Israel to proceed towards a final outcome that is shared by both. In other words, there really is no common vision here, unlike the process in South Africa.
My guest is Nasir Arouri. He's a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth. He's also a member of the Palestine National Council, the Palestinian Parliament in Exile. He's the author of several books on the Arab-Israeli conflict. His latest is called Occupation, Israel Over Palestine. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nasir Arouri. He serves on the Palestine National Council. He's also served on the board of Amnesty International and the board of the human rights group Middle East Watch. What does it mean to you personally to have the PLO recognize Israel and Israel recognize the PLO?
Well, I would like to say that perhaps had this been a real mutual recognition with parity and mutuality and equality, then I would say that this would probably fulfill my aspirations and that of a large sector of the Palestinian community, because I think that the Palestinians in the mid-1970s really gave up the idea of struggling for a unitary state in Palestine that would be a state for Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and they opted for two states coexisting side by side in Palestine. I'm afraid that the agreement that was concluded today, and the basis for which are these two documents that were concluded last week, are not really rooted in mutuality. But hopefully, they would lead toward that as they begin to discover a common necessity to end decades of warfare and perhaps realize that the only way they can share this land is through equality and mutual respect.
You don't think that this agreement is based on equality or full mutuality? What strikes you as being less than equal?
What's less than equal in it here is that when we look at the preamble of the Declaration of Principles, I think that what is really missing from it, what's missing from it are the important principles. For example, one of the clichés that are circulating around these days is that the devil is in the details. And I would say that the devil is not really in the details, but it is in the principles. There is a very important principle here that's missing, and that is a recognition that the peace that is going to take place here would have to really be based on the notion that there's an occupation that's been going on for 26 years, a prolonged occupation, that this occupation has to come to an end, that the acquisition of territory by force is inadmissible, so says the UN Resolution 242. And if these principles were there in the preamble, I think I would have probably felt more comfortable. But these principles are really missing from it.
How did you find out about the secret Norway negotiations, and what was your reaction when you found out?
Actually, I found out about it from the press, like everybody else, even though I should say here that just a few days before the news was released, I was attending a UN conference on Palestine in Vienna, Austria. And I did meet with a number of Palestinians who came from Tunis, who I don't think were really keeping it a secret, but I felt that they did not have a clue. I also met with people who normally would expect them to know. I mean, such as the chairman of the negotiating team in Washington. They did not know about it. I really, like many other people, I came to know about it from the press.
Do you think it was worth keeping it a secret to have this outcome?
Well, I think that a certain degree of secrecy is necessary for the success of negotiations. But I think that the agreements to really be successful probably needed some consultative process. I'm not saying here that it should really be presented to the entire parliament in exile, not so by any means, but at least the input of certain people would have been important. To mention one thing is perhaps a small team of legal scholars, people who know international law, might have been consulted. After all, Israelis tend to be very rigorous about agreements, and I do know that the other side is not really that rigorous. I think that the Arab side is convinced that their cause is just and that perhaps justice will prevail. But in the real world, that is not the way things go, really. At least a legal scrutiny would have been necessary.
How does this agreement change your opinion of Arafat, and how do you think it changes his status among the Palestinian people?
Well, I think that it depends really on what sector of the Palestinian people. It seems to me that the mainstream is rejoicing today. There's no question about it. I think that they view the struggle recently in terms of how acceptable the cause and its symbols, such as Arafat, has become acceptable to the United States. And therefore, the mere fact that Arafat lands at Andrew Air Force and that he goes to the State Department and that he addresses the American people with every congressman attending and so on and so forth, I think that this is viewed by them as positive. But I would like to say here that you really cannot underestimate the fact that you have other sectors that are far from being impressed, and particularly those whose problems are not answered by the agreement. In particular, I would say that hundreds of thousands of refugees who live in Lebanon and Syria and Jordan. Secondly, you have also the Palestinians in Israel who are citizens of Israel, but their status is not really very equal with that of Jews. And then you also have certain elements in the Palestinian body politic that do not endorse the agreement. So it just depends, really, on which Palestinian.
What kind of infighting do you expect there will be now between Palestinian groups, for instance, between Hamas, the more militant Islamic fundamentalist group, and the PLO?
Well, I think that the possibility of an inter-Nisan sort of conflict, of an inner conflict between the Palestinians, is there, but I would not say that it is extremely high, you know, possibility.
Why not? I mean, Hamas has said that they're going to fight this agreement.
Yes, I think that Hamas said that they will fight this agreement. But let's not forget here that the Palestinians in the occupied territories have suffered a great deal for 26 years under this prolonged occupation, which has really been very repressive. And for them, even though deliverance, independence, is not going to have to come about for some time to come and may not come about, I think that many of them really welcome the fact that there's going to be some sort of redeployment of Israeli armed forces, and that they will be able to at least experience a relative measure of freedom. This is one factor here to be considered. The other factor, I think, is going to depend on the ability and willingness of both parties to translate the ideas and principles in this agreement into concrete reality, one that is perhaps in synchronization with the minimum demands and aspirations of the Palestinian people. In other words, I think that if it is going to appear in the next few months that this process could ultimately lead to independence, then perhaps many of the skeptics and the Hamas people would be disarmed.
My guest is Nasir Arouri, a member of the Palestine National Council. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see how All Things Considered will be covering today's historic signing of the peace agreement between Israel and the PLO. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will you have?
We have all hands on deck today, Terry, to get as many views as we can from as many vantage points as we can. Ted Clark will lead off with an analysis of the event, who said what and what it means. We'll talk about the principles and we'll talk to some of the people who came. We will hear from the Middle East, from Linda Gradstein and from Robert Siegel. We will talk about the table on which the speech was signed. We'll hear a reprise of the speeches, a history which led us to this moment, and an interview with former Secretary of State James Baker.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're back with Nasir Arouri. He's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and a member of the Palestine National Council. What do you think the chances are of this agreement leading to a Palestinian state?
Well, as we look at the situation today, we have a string of statements from Rabin, and I recall him saying that in the early 1970s, and he hasn't changed his mind, to the effect that there will never be a Palestinian state. So independence, Palestinian state, is really against the, it is not on the Israeli agenda, and it is not on the American agenda. So there's a challenge, I think, to the Palestinians here, and I would surmise that many Palestinians are seeing it as a challenge to see about making independence not only something desirable, but necessary.
Could you be satisfied with any solution that doesn't create a Palestinian state?
Well, I really don't want to take the position that a state, no matter what, has got to be the final outcome. I am more concerned, really, about the notion of equality for every human being in the region. I think that if this principle is there, I mean, if we are having an agreement that is going to advance the notion of equality and human dignity for all, irrespective of class and creed and so on, then I certainly would be satisfied with it. And the reason I'm saying that is because the international relations have become fluid. I think that they have changed so much, and will probably change in the aftermath of the Cold War, to the extent that borders may not become so necessary. There will be really emphasis on the free movement of goods and services and individuals. And that people will not be insisting on lines and borders as they do in the past. I mean, I envision perhaps a Jerusalem with boroughs, like New York City, rather than the Israelis saying, this is Israel's capital until eternity, which is something that Mr. Rabin said today, and the Palestinians are saying, well, East Jerusalem should be the capital of the state.
I wonder if you're worried about the difficulty of Palestinians and Israelis stopping hating each other. I mean, there's been so many years of really deep hatred. I mean, how do you stop that?
Well, I mean, this hatred is not really, I mean, this is not something that is inherent in anybody's character, I should hope. Because if we look at recent history, we find that Arabs and Jews have really made contributions together to Western civilization. I was interested to see, and I was actually impressed, I should say, by the fact that Mr. Clinton, in his address, referred to the commonality, and he did find some interesting common denominators, which I'm not used to hearing, really, from U.S. officials when they talk about the Palestine question. But he did refer to the time in medieval Spain, when two people were making tremendous contributions. So given that, I guess that with the disappearance of the cause for hatred and resentment, I think that should subside. I mean, the cause is very simple. That is, the Palestinians lost their home to what became Israel, and their life had become really abnormal. I mean, they're either refugees, or people living under occupation, or they were second-class citizens in Israel. So if the reasons for this grievance disappear, then the hatred should disappear.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Nasir Arouri is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, and a member of the Palestine National Council. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, reporting on genocide in Bosnia, we talk with journalist Roy Gutman, foreign correspondent for Newsday. He and his photographer were the first Western journalists to report on mass executions in the concentration camps. Gutman's series of articles won him a Pulitzer Prize and are now collected in a new book. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.